Welcome to Mountain Money. I'm here with my host, Roger Goldman. Roger, how are you this morning?
Good morning, Kevin.
Good morning, everyone. So today on Mountain Money, we'll speak with Chef Pearson Shields of Matilda about, well, he's a celebrated chef, so let's talk about food. How's that? Then we'll speak with the presidents of all three Rotary clubs in Park City. That would be Crystal Bowman Carter of Park City Rotary, Steve Spaulding of Park City Sunrise Rotary, and Julie Stropel of Park City Twilight Rotary.
We'll finish our show by trying to score a touchdown by speaking with former executive director of the NFL Players Association, Damaris Smith. He's going to be talking about his new book, Turf Wars, The Fight for the Soul of America's Game. All this and more here on Mountain Money. Stay tuned.
Many visitors come to Park City not just for the great snow or wonderful hiking and biking trails, but for the food. We have many fantastic restaurants in town, and another one has just made that list, Matilda, over in Snow Creek Center. The decor is beautiful, and the food, delicious. We're fortunate enough to be joined by Matilda's chef, Chef Pearson Shields. Good morning. Welcome back to Mountain Money.
Right on. Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Indeed. So you were here back in December with Tilly's.
Yes.
Charcoal chicken. Yep. And at that time, you were hinting of the opening of Matilda. And you guys opened a few months back. How's business been?
It's been excellent. We were just excited to open. You know, coming from an urgent care, turning it into a restaurant was an experience. But we were so excited to open in late February. And it's been a hit. And in the summer, having the patio, people are really enjoying it. So it's been great for everybody, I think.
Nice.
And how many seats do you have, indoors and outdoors?
Altogether, we're right around 100, give or take. You know, we have the private dining room that we can close off up to 16 people, which has been great. And I think it'll be a huge hit come December with the large families that come in town or corporate groups. But, yeah, we can do 100 right now.
And that private room, will that be available for reservation in the holidays if you've got a big family, you want to be able to go back in there?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We can do custom menus. We can block off the private room. Anything people need, we're happy to accommodate over there.
So if there's something on the menu, let's say in the summertime and it switches in the winter, but they were here in the summer and they're coming in with a big family, could they say, hey, can we get that dish if they give you enough advance notice?
You know, it depends what it is. The big thing with Matilda is that menu is always going to be changing.
Yeah.
A lot of seasonal, a lot of local farmers. We've been changing the menu at least an item every other week, and it's been a ton of fun.
Well, let's talk about the menu. Give us a sense of the breadth of it, and what are your biggest hits?
Sure, for sure. We're real excited with the small and the shareable plates. It's a community restaurant. We want people to come in, order a ton of food, and pass that food around so everyone can enjoy. So for us, yes, we have pizzas with the giant oven and an open kitchen, so it's fun to see everyone working, but as a whole, just changing the menu up, and you know, right now with the tomatoes, the peaches, corn coming online, we're loving it. And with that, unfortunately, we took a few things off, but they'll be back. You know, like the beef tartare was a huge hit. We took it off not because of any other reason, but the peaches were just too good to pass up.
Yeah, it is peach season around here. So, is there a specific cuisine that you would call it?
No, we're very Australian influenced. You know, one of my business partners, Ian Pope, he has a huge influence on the menu, and you know, he's the owner of Five Seeds as well with the other two gentlemen, Mark and Price. But we really just try to mix it up with seasonality for the most part. So if one of the chefs comes up with a cool idea, we try it, we play with it, and we go from there.
And how many chefs are there?
So there's three of us in total. At running around Matilda. So myself, you know, Ian has a huge part, and then Chef Alex, who came up from Salt Lake City. We're stoked to have him with us, so it's
nice.
Been great.
So no one actually, you know, during the opening of the restaurant, no one actually created the original menu, or did you all kind of have a hand in it?
Everybody had a hand in it, but the original menu definitely was the brainchild with Ian, yeah, for sure. Mm-hmm. He studied, and he had something that he really wanted to accomplish, and the original menu was just, it was great. And we've only built on it from there.
Yeah.
So you mentioned that, you know, the peaches are in. Talk a little bit about how you sort of identify what's attractive and then decide to source it and add it to the menu. You know, how do you sort of monitor what's going on in the world and adapt it to the menu?
I mean, a lot of times if people are local, it's easy. You know, there's a couple, you know, Kev's tomatoes that we use and his greens, they've been great. But if you're going to go with the peaches, it kind of depends on weather and insects and all that and what's been happening around the region. So taking the peaches out of Palisade for the most part has been easy this year, but it really determines on the weather and just the availability as a whole. We've been really lucky to meet some great farmers that bring things up and offer them to us. And it could be for a week, it could be for 6 weeks, and we just take it and we figure out what to do with it as a group.
So the peaches were coming from Palisades, Colorado?
Yes, these peaches are from Palisades, Colorado.
And now you're going to be hitting some of the, Brigham City up there on that little stretch of old State Street.
For sure, they're definitely coming online. I think the move with the peaches, we're about 3 weeks. We have about another 3 weeks with them. Mm-hmm. Tomatoes, at least another month, which will be great. And again, you know, we get those from Kev. Down in Heber, Camas area, and yeah. it's been easy to get, but it comes and goes.
This is the part of the restaurant business that we don't see. Like mm-hmm. we have no idea, you know, how it is that different ingredients wind up in your restaurant. So you mentioned that some of this is with people that actually come to you, they proactively market to you. Some of this, I take it, is with some of the relationships that Five Seeds has already established with various vendors. And how dynamic is it? I mean, how often will somebody say, you know, come into you and say, you know what, we're going to have something interesting next week, next month, and then you react and think, okay, how can I use that? Is that how it works?
It is and it isn't. You know, mm-hmm. there's certain people that do come in and it's, I just grew this and I'd love you guys to have it and I'd love you to use it. But truthfully, it's less and less. We'd love to have farmers come in and offer things up. You know, that's a huge chunk of what Matilda is and wants to be. But for us, it's more going to the farmers market and meeting these people that, mm-hmm. that come in from 60, 80, 100 miles away. And then we're building those relationships and it, you know, asking, you know, next week, can you bring 6 cases? And they will. But it's starting that relationship. It's less and less people coming to us, more we're meeting them at different events.
And even this local farmers market, which many of us view as a place for us to buy some vegetables and some barbecue, that's actually a place that you guys can start relationships.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You know, the farmers, the ranchers, they've been great. They're super fun. You learn their story. You learn the history. And they all bring the best of the best of what they have to offer. So why not use it?
Sure.
Yeah. So the present menu you have at Matilda, mm-hmm. what's your favorite item to eat and what's your favorite item to cook?
Good questions. I would say favorite one now is to harp on the peaches some more. We have a stracciatella, peaches, balsamic, and then we put some roasted Fresno peppers. So you have that savory, you have some heat with it. I think it's great with our flatbread because you can eat it as a whole. You can dip the flatbread in the cheese. It's been excellent. Mm-hmm. And then you got to go with the pizza. I mean, that pizza was blood, sweat, and tears for us for over a year to develop it. So I have to go with one of the pizzas for sure.
I'll have to try pizza next time.
The flatbread's pretty interesting as well, yeah.
With the Kev's tomatoes.
Mm-hmm. But not flat. That's
not flat.
It's not flat. It's puffy.
It's very puffy.
So now this is part of a restaurant group with what restaurants total?
So we are Matilda. Originally it was Five Seeds and then Tilly's Charcoal Chicken out in Kimball Junction.
And Five Seeds and Matilda are side by side next to the old Dan's?
Yes, sharing a wall. So we can work with them whenever we need, share some staff and have some fun. But yeah, definitely.
So you can right share staff. So people can work in the morning at Five Seeds and then in the evening at Matilda.
Yes, a couple of the staff members do that. I don't know how they pull it off because couldn't work at Five Seeds and then go work at Matilda and see that many people in a day. But
yeah,
some people can pull it off. But absolutely, you know, it's great to be able to use different people that want it, you know, with catering and all that. So if they know the entire menu, it's easier on us. It's more efficient as a whole.
Yeah, exactly. So let's back up a little bit and let's hear about Pearson Shield. Let's hear about you. Tell us about yourself, where you're from.
Okay.
Where have you worked? Where have you trained?
Give
our listeners a lowdown.
Grew up outside of Cleveland, between Cleveland and Akron in Ohio. Went to culinary school in Chicago at Kendall College. And I spent a bunch of time in hotels. So for me, I did 7 hotels, 10 openings, and got passed around mostly West Coast is where I got a ton of experience. Thought that grass was greener on the other side, left hotels, and I toured with Kenny Chesney for a while. Wow. And that was fun. But
was that you on the drums?
It was not me on the drums, but it could have been me on stage at one point. But you know, sleeping in a bus that's 6 feet by 4 feet, I'm slightly larger than that. So it was a tough lifestyle for the time being. But yeah. No, and then came to Park City with the St. Regis, mm-hmm. and I was fortunate enough to meet the gentleman that had 5 seeds at the time, and we hit it off. And as the idea turned into a concept, then we wanted to, you know, I wanted something different, so jumped on it.
The restaurant is Matilda. It is located in, where is it located? It's in
1600 Snow Park.
In Snow Park, right by the restaurant formerly known as Dan's.
And can they get the menu on your website?
Absolutely. Menu's on there. Catering's on there. You can book reservations on that website. We use Resy, so.
Okay, and what's the website?
It's Matilda.com or Matilda Park City if you're going to Google it.
Yeah. Okay. Pearson Shields, thanks for spending time with us. We'll be right back after this. Kevin and I are surrounded by Rotary presidents this morning here in the studio. We have Julie Strobel of the Twilight Club. We have Crystal Bowman Carter of the Noon Club. And we have Steve Spalding of the Sunrise Club. They're here to tell us a little more about Rotary, why they do what they do, and what Rotary does. Let me start with Steve. Can you give us a little background on the creation and history of Rotary?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Roger. Good to be here. So Rotary has been around over 100 years. The first club, which is the Rotary Club of Chicago, was founded in 1905. And originally it was so professionals could exchange ideas and form friendships. Over time, Rotary has evolved, and we are now focusing a lot on humanitarian service around the world. We've got 1.4 million members in 45,000 clubs in over 130 countries. So we are a big organization.
And Julie, can you explain Rotary's 7 areas of focus, please?
You bet. So Rotary International focuses its efforts across 7 key areas. Just kind of then we can structure our service projects and grants around those. And they are peace building and conflict prevention, disease prevention and treatment, water, sanitation and hygiene, maternal and child health, basic education and literacy, community economic development, and protecting the environment.
That's a lot.
It is a lot.
And how many members again, Steve, worldwide?
We have 1.4 million members worldwide.
To do those 7 steps. And is it being accomplished?
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, different chapters focus on different areas. You don't have to do all 7 areas of focus. For example, like we have a literacy program that Twilight does where we read with elementary schools. So we focus on helping those first graders with literacy, and they each go home with a book after we've read it to them. So each chapter can focus on different sections.
Oh, good. Yeah, I've done that reading program.
Yeah, it's great.
I enjoy it. Mm-hmm,
very fun.
And hey, Crystal, service above self.
Yes.
General concepts of the 4-way test. Tell us first about service above self. What it's a motto. What does it mean exactly?
Well, it's Rotary's motto that was adopted in 1989. It's intended to encourage Rotarians to put the needs of others before their own needs and to prioritize the service to their communities. This motto guides Rotarians in their volunteer work and community engagement, promoting international understanding, goodwill, and peace.
Let's take it down a level. We talk about the 4-way test, and I know that for a long time at the Noon Club, Kevin and I have to do full disclosure, both of us are members of the Noon Club, which you know we think is the best club, but I'm sure that we could get a different view from our friends.
I beg to differ.
That's what I want to hear.
Oh, exactly.
Okay, so Crystal, what is the 4-way test?
So the 4-way test goes back even farther. That was created in 1932. It's a nonpartisan, non-sectarian ethical guide for Rotarians to use in their personal and professional lives. It's intended to encourage individuals to consider the impact of their actions on others and to strive for fairness, goodwill, and positive outcomes for all. It consists of four questions. Are you ready for the four questions?
Let's hit it.
Is it the truth? Is it fair to all concerned? Will it build goodwill and better friendships? And will it be beneficial to all concerned?
So Julie, let's take it down to a practical level. Give us some other examples of what the local, what are some of the projects that you've most enjoyed working with at the Twilight Club?
We have lots of service projects we do. We do a roadside cleanup. We worked with the Christian Center. We do several blood drives a year, work with the food bank, Days for Girls. Our major fundraiser is the Bark City 5K, which takes place on Miner's Day this year. That's September 1st. It's a great event where you can run or walk with your dog. It takes place on the historic rail trail starting at the Miner's Hospital, 8 o'clock a.m., and it's just a great way to start out your day with some fresh air, some exercises, and then head to the picnic breakfast and up to Main Street.
Well, you now set up Crystal when you use the word Miner's Day. Crystal, tell us a little bit about the Noon Club and its involvement with Miner's Day.
So Miner's Day is on Labor Day, and that's...
No, Labor Day is Miner's Day. It's really
Miner's
Day.
Oh, I stand corrected. You're right. It's Miner's Day, and it's a big deal. It's a fun event put on historically by the Park City Noon Rotary Club. The city has taken over a little bit of the management recently, but our big fundraiser for the year is the Miner's Day Running of the Balls, where we take 15,000 golf balls, individually numbered, that are going to be cleaned this week so we can renumber them, and run them down Main Street. People have bought those balls or sponsored those balls, and the winning numbers get prizes like Deer Valley passes, concerts in their backyard, passes to yoga, things like that.
And what kind of money do you raise, and what do you do with it?
We raise cold, hard cash. Is that what you meant? We raised over $120,000 last year, and we use that to fund our large and small grants. Last year, we gave away, or 2024, we gave away $100,000 in large grants to the Holy Cross Ministries, Peace House, and Hope Alliance. And then we also gave away $36,000 in small grants. So that's more than we brought in net from Miner's Day, but we have other fundraising revenue sources as well.
And we have to give the Noon Club, the Sunrise Club a shot here. What's your big fundraiser?
Well, so we are involved in many different service projects, and I will say that we encourage all of our members to participate in something. Not everybody has to do everything, but the one big thing that we try to get everybody to participate in, and it's our big money maker, is the Shot Ski. Which, for those of you who don't know, I don't know why you wouldn't know, but those who don't know, that's where we take over Main Street, and we have all of the skis lined up with shots of High West whiskey, and everybody does a simultaneous shot. We've got over 1,500 people who do this at the same time, and this is a competition, a good nature competition, with Breckenridge Rotary, and between the two of us, we try to set a record every year.
And who holds the record for the longest or most people shot ski?
Well, I mean, so it just goes back and forth. So I guess it depends on when you ask. Ours is going to be in October 11th. And then Breckenridge, I think they do it in December. So, just depending on the moment, it's either us or them.
Didn't we have a third Canadian entry?
Well, yeah. So there is a Canadian ski resort that... unbeknownst to us, they participated in doing some kind of shot ski. We officially don't recognize it.
We don't recognize Canada anymore.
No, I love Canada. But we don't recognize it because they didn't do it as a fundraiser, and they didn't do it as a paid event. They just basically took skiers off the mountain and said, hey, you want to do a shot? So... they have actually come to the table and said that they would like to start to do it within the same parameters as Breckenridge and Park City.
Oh, that would be fun, a three-way competition
across
borders. And so October 11th, you said?
Yep.
And they can find information on that at what website?
That's going to be at...
I'm going to jump over to Julie real quick. How can they sign up for the Park City 5K?
PCTwilightRotary.org is information. And then if you Google Miner's Day, there's a whole website with all sorts of information to do with Miner's Day. So you can do it there as well.
Excellent. And Crystal, what's the website for the Miner's Day?
It's MinersDayParkCity, I believe, .org. But let me double check that.
And while our Rotary presidents are busily checking their phones, Julie, when do you meet and how can people find out more about possibly joining?
Absolutely. Yes, we are a new chapter in town. So we just meet in the evenings to give another option for Park City people to be involved in Rotary. We meet the first and third Wednesdays at Lush's Barbecue from 6 to 7:30.
And if people are interested, can they just show up?
Absolutely. And find out more? We love visitors.
Steve, when do you meet and how can people find out more?
Yeah, absolutely. So we meet on every Thursday, so four times a month at Hyatt Place on 224, just kind of down at the base of Canyons. And we meet at 7:30 in the morning. And we would love for people to just come check it out. We usually have we've got a speaker every week. So it's a great opportunity to kind of find out what's going on in the community and meet some really wonderful people.
And Crystal, what about the Noon Club?
We meet at noon. really 12:15. We start our program at 12:30. We meet at the Doubletree, which is right at the intersection of Kearns and, Park Ave, every Tuesday.
True Parkites call it the Yarrow.
I was going to say, that's where we started our meetings at the Yarrow in 1980, and we came back, I think, in 2020 after going to the Grubstake for a while, but now we're at the Yarrow.
And how many members in the Noon Club?
We are the largest club in Utah. We have 145 members with, Salt Lake used to be the largest club with over 300 members. I don't know how that happened, but currently we hold that title.
Well, maybe they split. And Steve, how many in the Morning Club?
We have 92 members in the Morning Club.
Outstanding. And Julie, how many in the Twilight Club?
We're right around 30.
Good. So there's a club for anyone. If you're working in the middle of the day, you can do the morning if you don't start right away. Or the, do you guys serve margaritas? I heard rumors that you guys serve margaritas in the Twilight Club.
We have beer and wine at Lush's.
Outstanding.
Yeah. We're the fun club for sure.
Anything else to touch on before we go?
I did want to reiterate, it is parkcityminersday.org.
Rotary presidents, thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back after this.
The National Football League is a very big business. 19 of the most watched TV broadcasts in history were Super Bowls, and the league carefully cultivates its image in many, many ways. But there are a lot of ugly truths behind that image. Dee Smith was the executive director of the National Football League Players Association, the Players Union. And he's got a lot of nuanced stories to tell about football and some of the larger issues in his new book, Turf Wars, The Fight for the Soul of America's Game. We're lucky to be joined by Dee again this morning. Good morning, Dee, and welcome back to Mountain Money.
Thank you, brother. Good to see you. It's been a while.
It is good to see you. I haven't seen you in a while as well. Dee, you and I have shared some prior experiences. You have a fascinating career path. Can you share a bit about that career and how it led you to become the head of the NFLPA?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think my wife best describes it as my inability to keep a job. But after law school, I worked for a small white collar firm for a relatively short amount of time. But then I spent 10 years at the U.S. Attorney's Office, 7 years of that in violent crime and homicide, a short stint in terrorism. And then after that, I went to become the chief counsel to then Deputy Attorney General Eric Holder. I did that for 2 years. And then I joined a small law firm called Latham & Watkins, where I was there for 10 years. And then I left, went to Patton Boggs for 2 years. And then in 2009, I was elected to be the executive director of the NFL Players Association.
You know, you talk about that transition kind of glibly as if it's no big deal. I was a lawyer and then I was the head of the NFLPA. But it was pretty extraordinary. I mean, you were not a former football player. Talk a little bit about how it is that you managed to land that job. It's detailed in the book. It's a great story.
Well, I remember getting a call from a headhunter. At the time, I was working on the justice transition team for President-elect Obama at the time. And really my only goal at that point was to go back to the U.S. Attorney's Office to be the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia. And I got a call from a headhunter and they said, would you be interested in being a candidate for the executive director job. And I said, that's literally the most insane thing I've ever heard. I'm not qualified for the job. I never represented a player, never represented a team, never represented anybody in sports. I didn't take sports law in law school. But as an aside, of course, I go back to the University of Virginia every year that my sports law professor, you know, asked me to come. And my pitch there is go to the University of Virginia because apparently it doesn't matter what class you take, you can get a job. So I went and talked to the executive committee, and I'll never forget, you know, they asked me, why do you want this job? And I said, I don't. You guys called me. I know how to conduct war, you know, at Latham and at Patton Boggs. I've represented some big clients, and you know the drill. We were in a few of those cases together. We won't mention who, but you know how to protect your client, and you know that you have to come up with a multifaceted strategy to meet, you know, whatever war is presented your way, and whether that's a fighting in a courtroom or fighting on Capitol Hill or having a robust press media strategy, a grassroots strategy. I knew how to do those things. And the players said, we think you are qualified for this job. Lo and behold, I went to Hawaii and ran against two former NFLPA presidents. And for some crazy reason, they decided unanimously to pick the other guy.
Kevin's got a question, but yeah, so first I have to point out that you came this close to sharing a position with Jeanine Pirro.
You know, Roger, I don't know if I have any more time for this conversation.
Go ahead, Kevin.
Let's just say that when it comes to what she does and what I was going to do, we could not be more different.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we're going to jump into some of the great stories in the book. Before we do, can you share a bit about your perspective on the club of the NFL owners and how they regard the players?
You know, the history of the league and the practice of the league is best framed by just the reality. Next year, the National Football League will probably either come close or do slightly better than $25 billion of revenue in 1 year. $25 billion. Now, the players will get half of that. But that ecosystem is one where you have 31 owners. The Green Bay Packers are a publicly owned team. But you have 31 owners, and even though they will do that $25 billion of revenue, when you think about it like a lawyer, a few things become abundantly clear. There are no 10-Ks. There are no 10-Qs. There's no SEC oversight. There's no Department of Justice oversight. There's no audited financial statements. There's never an annual report. And as a result, you are in a system where 31 billionaires operate what I would consider to be the largest socialistic business enterprise in the country without any oversight. And at the end of the day, this machine every year is fueled by a group of highly skilled employees who arrive fully trained from college. Mm-hmm. No one invests in making these people employees. They come fully formed. And even if you are the richest person in the world, you are not entitled to own a team. You have to be voted in to this country club. So that's the ecosystem that we start with. And then if you simply scratch the surface of the history of the National Football League, in 1933, the owners made a handshake agreement to bar black athletes. The National Football League did not integrate until Kenny Washington came into the league in 1947, and he became a member of the Los Angeles Rams. By the way, his college team was Woody Strode, Kenny Washington, and does anybody know?
Mm-mm.
Jackie Robinson.
No kidding.
College football team.
Right. That was his college football team. So they integrate in 1947, and they only integrate because they're playing at the Los Angeles Coliseum. And the city council says, if you don't integrate, we will not let you play at this public Coliseum owned by the people. So government action led to the integration of the National Football League, not the owner's graces about who are the best athletes. The last team to integrate are the Washington team at the time. Bobby Mitchell integrates the Washington team in 1968.
Holy
and God. once again, they only integrate because they're playing at what would later be called RFK Stadium, which at the time, just like the Rams, a public stadium. And so the city council and Congress says, we will not let you, George Preston Marshall, play a game where you are a rampant segregationist. And we will not let you play at the People's Stadium unless you integrate. So this idea that these wonderful NFL owners are simply overcome with presenting the public with a fine quality football game that matches the equality and the integrity of our community is simply false. They only do what they're forced to do. And the reality is, in their system, the only people who can stand up to the owners is this relatively small labor union run by a group of people who are mostly in their 20s.
Yeah.
And again, that idea
that I don't have a love loss. As you can probably see, I don't have much of a love loss about the owners, and I won't be getting any holiday gifts from any of them after the book comes out. But I'll be okay.
You don't get Christmas cards, huh?
It's weird, right? I mean, I keep waiting for that Jerry Jones card. You know, it's going to come today. Yeah. It's going to come today. Yeah.
And there are a lot of great stories in the book about some of the owners, these people that we've seen on television, and many of them sort of reinforced some of my beliefs about what jerks they were. But I want to talk a little bit. You set up a paradigm, right, where we have this giant industry that doesn't file 10-Ks, doesn't disclose, doesn't answer to anybody, except maybe the union. And that's why, you know, isn't that part of the fundamental story of the book about how you tried to and how the union, in fact, you know, is the only thing that sort of gives these guys any real grief?
It's the only thing that stands in the breach. Right. And you know, at the beginning of the book, as you know, I sort of posed this question. If you knew that you were going to make $25 billion every year and not have any accountability, what would you do? And so what I tried to do in this union, and I had some, I mean, frankly, great players to work with. But most importantly, I had some great teachers, and I was able to spend some time with Marvin Miller before he passed away. I was appointed to the AFL-CIO Executive Council by Rich Trumka, who ran the coal miners union for years. I sat side by side with the United Farm Workers, did battle with LIUNA and the culinary union. So, you know, thankfully, relatively quickly, I got my head around this idea that unlike, Roger Aurel world, where Company A, Company B, there's some sort of fight between them. You and I both know that if we can't resolve this, there's going to be a court system. There's going to be a Congress. There's going to be laws. There's going to be some leveler, right? And we typically leverage the possibility that this might be meted out in a courtroom as a way to reach a private settlement. In the National Football League, there is no such thing. The only force that stands in the breach is the union. And, you know, when you walk into a fight like I did in 2009, the deal that the owners put on the table at the time was, hey, D, we got a great deal for you. We want the players to play two extra games for free. We want to take 20% of their salary, and we want to eliminate their pensions. I mean, other than those three things, it was a great deal. I mean, I'm still stunned why the players just didn't overwhelmingly say yes, but they didn't. And the players decided that they were going to fight, and we made adjustments that we had to make. We got out of that with a deal that we could live with a share of revenue that no longer drops. We got out of that with new concussion protocols that I know saved players' lives. But economically, up until that point, and I think Roger's the oldest person on the call. I think.
No question.
But, you know.
Possibly the oldest person in the audience, but that's neither here nor there. Go ahead.
But, you know, there was a time when there was a 12-game season. And I remember when it was a 14-game season. And I certainly remember when it went to a 16-game season. You know, for the listeners, they should understand that when it went from a 12-game season to a 14-game season to a 16-game season, the players never got paid more money. The league had the unilateral right to go up to 21 games. Unilateral. So the way that I explain it to my students is think about, you know, you do a five-day shift at the local pizza parlor. The manager comes in at the end of your shift on Friday and says, I've got a great idea. Here's what we're going to do. Instead of you working 5 days, you're going to work Saturday and Sunday. And, you know, you're going to get the same minimum wage. And somebody raises their hand and they say, well, wait a minute, though, but that's longer than my regular work week. Shouldn't I get a higher wage on Saturday and Sunday because it's overtime? And the owner says, yeah, but we're all going to make more money. It's going to be great. Well, everyone would look at that and say, well, you're screwing us, right? And then, so when I looked at the 2006 deal, and there was some great stuff in the 2006 deal, but the inability to control our work literally put the players in such a bad position. After 2011, we won the right to veto any increase in the season. So we fast forward to 20, and the league certainly wants a 17th game, and the players had to make a decision about whether they wanted to play a 17th game, and the majority of them agreed that they wanted to play a 17th game. Well, the rub of that, though, was that we got $200,000 increases on every minimum wage salary in the National Football League. 70% of our guys play for minimum salary. So overnight, a $200,000 raise. And most importantly, when we added the 17th game, Roger bought that game for $1.6 billion over 10 years. Mm-hmm. And it was a game he had for free in 2011. Mm-hmm. So every now and then, it's important for me to stick it to the man.
Yeah, I want to go back to 2011. Because it's one of my favorite stories in the book, and part of it is because our mutual friend Dave Barrett makes a cameo. One of my favorite stories in the book is about the idea of lockout insurance. Can you talk a little bit about how that got set up?
I can give you the sanitized version of the story for our listeners, or the unsanitized version. Just tell me which one you want. Well, you know, David and I, he referred to Dave Barrett, who's a brilliant lawyer at Latham. I would say this, Latham hired both him and his brother, twin brother, which I think they did because they got some sort of discount, of course. But Dave is a brilliant insurance lawyer. You and I both know a former partner named Mark Newell. And I worked on a case with Mark that dealt with the Ford Motor Company. And I was forced to learn insurance from Dave Barrett, which to this day requires hundreds of hours of therapy. But at the end of that, Dave and I had settled a case. We started talking about this idea of the frame of our problem. The players had $200 million in the bank in 2010, 2011. The owners had secured $4 billion from the networks to lock the players out, even if there were no games. And so the idea that started to germinate with us was that scenario placed all of the risk onto the players. What if we could transfer that risk in some way with an idea that maybe we could buy insurance that if the players were locked out for the entire year, we could pay a premium. And if the players were locked out for the entire year, that insurance policy would pay a portion of their salary for the entire year. We knew it would never pay their full salary. But that's not the point. The reason why the risk transfer became really important was because, you know, from a lawyer game strategy, and this is what, you know, I learned from Roger and other smart people at Latham, it's understanding the game strategy. And so the owner's game strategy was that the players will fold somewhere between week 4 and week 7. But the lockout is not going to go the entire season. Because, again, the players had a history of 3 failed strikes. And by the way, that's a pretty good game strategy that the players would fold after week 4, 5, or 6. So that also told me that if they're banking on the players folding sometime before week 7, more importantly, they've told their bankers, right, who are carrying the notes on their stadiums, that, look, we're not going to miss the whole season. We might miss the first 5 or 6 games, but the season is going to come back. As soon as the season comes back, the NFL will start paying those notes on all those stadiums that, by the way, we know all of the owners personally guaranteed as the last line of defense. Because remember, when this happened, we're coming out of the 2008 Great Recession. So you couldn't get a $4 million loan, let alone a $4 billion loan. So we went into the market. I would tell you the various companies that we got the insurance from, but I would have to fly out there and kill both of you. But at the end of the day, we bought an insurance policy, and it's all public, that would have paid the players close to $900 million if we would have gone the whole season. And we held that card secret until the very end. And at the very end, when we had negotiated the deal as hard as we could, we slapped the insurance policy down like 4 aces and said, if we don't get the final things that we need, this lockout is going to go the whole season. And you might think that I'm your enemy, but if this lockout goes the whole season, your enemy is going to be your own bankers. Yeah. And that's how we got the deal done.
And where did that deal originate? Where were you hanging out? I heard
You made me tell the story.
Yeah.
We had settled a case out in Palm Springs, and Dave and I, with our, you know, his illustrious Latham background and my background is now the current executive director, we were at a Chili's knee deep in about 7 margaritas.
Okay, let's.
I only spend the big money.
I want to move on to some of the other. There are many, many great stories in this book. I want you to talk a little bit about the role, because part of this story includes a more than a cameo by Tom Brady and sort of working and sort of the sort of role that Kraft plays within the owner's sort of club.
Yeah, Tom, look, it's Tom Brady. So, you know, he's a model trapped in a athlete's body. I mean, that's literally what he is. And Tom gets sort of anybody who is Tom Brady is going to have far more myths about them than truths. But the best story I know about Tom was the Patriots, I think, were the second team that I visited after I was elected. And that day, I think Real Sports had decided to shoot some B-roll of me walking into the stadium for Bryant Gumbel's Real Sports. And it was my first time in a Patriot place. And there's a door that you walk into where the players walk in. And it's just a door with a long hallway. So fine, you know, they mic me up and it's my first time into the stadium and it's me walking in and I put my hand on the door and I open it up and I walk in and the camera's behind me and I realize I have no idea where I'm going. I don't know where the room is. I don't know what time it starts. So I walk down the hallway, just kind of, and nobody's there. And I make a right. And when I make a right, there sitting down in a chair is Tom Brady. And he stands up. And I know, you know, not many people have stood next to Tom Brady, but he is ginormous. Hmm. I mean, he's tall. And the guy kept unfolding like a ladder. he stood up. And one thing I will say about Tom, and I like to kid him for a bunch of reasons, but Tom is also a low talker. He's an eye locker and he's a low talker. So I don't have to do it this way. I say, hey, I'm D. Smith. And he goes, hey, I'm I'm Tom Brady. I'm like, well, I know who you are, and also, why can't I hear you? And I said, well, why are you here? And he goes, well, Dean, you just got elected to be the executive director, and it's like. He finally turns to me, and literally, this is what he says: "You just got elected to be our executive director. You're our leader, and I thought it was really important that I walk you into the team meeting."
Whoa.
Yeah. And
that's a champ.
He walked to the team meeting, which, you know, for any leader, that validation, right, is important. And later on, when we decided to sue the league in 2011, to me, it was really important to send a message to the owners that this wasn't the same old NFL Players Union. And so it was very important that the lead plaintiffs in that case went by the name of Tom Brady, Drew Brees, and Peyton Manning.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I got close to Kraft literally while his wife was dying of cancer. And Myra passed away a week before us signing the collective bargaining agreement in 2011. And we had reached an impasse, I would say sometime around mid-July. You know, and literally, I mean, that's when training camp's gonna start. And we hadn't yet played the card of the insurance case, you know, of the insurance policy. And we were getting to that point where I knew we had to play it. And we had suspended negotiations because they had just cratered. And literally, I left Washington and I went to Boston because my son was in a baseball camp. And I decided I was just going to play baseball with my kid and coach baseball because there was nothing else to do. And literally one day the phone rings. It's Bob Kraft, and he says, "Dee, I think we should get together for one more try." And I met Bob at Robert at his hangar, jumped on his plane. He turned to me and he said, "Myra doesn't have long to live." And we flew to New York together. And honestly, I thought, under what circumstances would I ever leave my dying wife to do a football club? And I realized that that's the Robert Kraft that cares about the whole of the NFL. I think a lot of owners care about their individual piece. And we won't mention any names, Jerry Jones. But the reality is Robert thinks of it as a whole. And I truly believe that he considers it a privilege to be a part of this business. And he thought that labor peace was something worth getting together.
Yeah.
And for that and for years, I learned more and probably the most I've ever learned in my life in business from Robert.
Nice. So we only have a couple minutes left, but before we go, please tell me what the Ray Rice incident tells us about the way the league views different types of behavioral issues.
Yeah, I mean, look, the league at the end of the day is more about control than it is about money. And yes, the money comes, it just comes. But the way the league thinks about it is they believe that the money is a byproduct of control. And so whether it was Deflategate or Bounty or Ray Rice or StarCaps or Kaepernick or Anthem, and I went through all of those, it was always a battle about who was going to control the entire system. And Ray Rice, look, I was a homicide prosecutor for 8 years. When I saw that tape, my head snapped back to prosecutor days immediately. And anybody who has a daughter or a son or a child, you see that and you are horrified by it. The flip side of it is every union member has a duty of fair representation. And that means that the union will rise to the occasion and defend them in the system. And I make no apologies to do that. The Ray Rice the Ray Rice battle became more of a battle of will the league control everything. So they punished him the first time, punished him the second time, punished him the third time. And we simply took the position that punishing someone three times for the same conduct violates his rights. And you know, the one of the more interesting stories out of that whole affair, and talking about what the role of lawyers in America and in the system, we won that case because a lawyer named Heather McPhee, who is a former Latham lawyer herself, almost finished her PhD at Columbia in English, graduated summa cum laude from Princeton, is one of the most fierce lawyers that I've, and brilliant lawyers that I've ever met. She took the notes of Ray Rice's first visit with Roger Goodell, and the independent arbitrator at the end of the day decided that in this battle about whether Ray Rice told the truth to the commissioner and thus couldn't be punished a third time, this judge credited the handwritten notes of one Heather McPhee as being the turning point for that entire case. And I love her to death. I think she is just literally one of the most tremendous forces of nature that I've ever met. And it was a privilege to work, you know, side by side with people like her and the players for 15 years.
Dave, before we go, we touched on a lot of the stories. I mean, the book, we encourage people to, I encourage people to look at the book because stories like Deflategate, like Bountygate, and also sort of some of the bigger issues of your life and the roles of race and in society and in the NFL are fascinating. Wish we had more time. Dee, it's always a pleasure to talk to you. Thanks for spending so much time with us this morning.
You too, brother. Thank you very much.
Talk to you soon.
Thank you.